A warm greeting to the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Sydney, Dr. Michael Spence, and the Reverend Beth Spence. To Mrs. Eileen Perkins, Hetty Perkins and her family, also Adam, Rachel, and all of the members of this amazingly talented mob. To Tom Carmer and Sam Jeffries, to other inaugural members of the new National Congress here this evening. To every one of you who've flown or driven a long way to be here on this special night, and to Janet Mooney, Director of the Currie Centre, for bringing this 10th anniversary oration. It is a special night for our gifted orator because we needed a very special woman to talk about one of our greatest men. Dr. Kerry Arabina, we welcome you here this evening. It is a great occasion every year of this decade because Charles Perkins, without doubt, is one of the greatest Australians. He, and this will come through in this 10th anniversary oration, he allows us to honour not only the fact that he was the first Indigenous graduate from the University of Sydney, but he was an Australian that led us to understand that excellence in education and the belief that every Australian child should have that quality, that is great leadership. This makes him truly one of our finest statesmen of all time. And I myself look forward to the day when we will have, in every hall like this around the country, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men and women that we recognise the greatness of what they have done in their leadership and the quality of their minds. So the little things tonight, turn off the mobile phones and relax. Lean back and just have some reflective time when we listen to the speakers tonight, some deep thinking time. That's what is special about the Charles Perkins Oration evening and indeed the prize that reflects what Charles wanted for Australian children to provide educational excellence. This oration began in 2001. And here we are a decade later, and many of the issues that have been discussed here every year are still before us. There is a lot of unfinished business. But Charles' life, his life's work, and his belief, his hopefulness that we would find a way to work together is also a very special part each year of this gathering. Because it brings us together from all over the country, those who believe in the quality, the excellence of education, and the entitlement, the human right that every child has to that education. To connect us to those longer timelines of Australian knowledge that I began to talk about, it's a great pleasure to have with us tonight Mr. Charles Madden, a member of the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Council, a director of the Aboriginal Medical Service in Redfern for over 30 years, an extraordinary accomplishment in itself, and one that I've always thought was pretty good too. He's the proud ticket holder of life membership in the Redfern All Blacks Junior Rugby League Football Club. So put your hands together, please, for Mr. Charles Chicka Madden.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, my name is Charles Madden, known around the inner city here as Chicka. I am a director with the Aboriginal Medical Service at Redfern and a director with the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Land Council. I'd like to take this opportunity this afternoon to extend a warm and sincere welcome to all my Aboriginal brothers and sisters, non-Aboriginal brothers and sisters, welcome to Gadigal land Aboriginal land. The Gadigal clan is one of 29 that makes up the Eora Nation. And the Eora Nation is bordered by three distinctive landmarks. We have the Hawkesbury River to the north, Nepean to the west, and the Georges River to the south. The three rivers form the boundary of the Eora Nation. If you travel across this great city of ours this afternoon, the state or this great country, welcome to Gadigal land. If we have any brothers and sisters here from the Torres Strait or from further afar across the seas, a warm and sincere welcome to Gadigal land, Aboriginal land. Enjoy your evening and have a safe and trouble-free trip home. Once again, welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you.
I now invite the Vice-Chancellor and Principal of the University of Sydney, Dr. Michael Spence, to share with you why Sydney University sees this as such an important evening in Australian education.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Madden, for your welcome to country. This is a place where knowledge has been developed and treasured for thousands of years, and that's a tradition that we hope that we preserve here at the University of Sydney. Welcome to the Perkins family. Welcome particularly to Neville Perkins, who compared this event for 9 years, for its first 9 years of existence, but also to all the rest of the family and to staff and friends of the university. This time last year, we had just received a review that had 46 recommendations about Indigenous education and research at the university. They were recommendations that covered everything from how we make sure that Senate is more aware of issues in Indigenous education and research, all the way through to how we look after the Indigenous education of Indigenous students, and in particular also the Indigenous education of non-Indigenous students, how we make sure that people more generally understand issues in Indigenous education and research. 46 recommendations. Well, it takes an institution like this quite a long time to chew over a report like that. There were some that we could implement immediately, and we did, and some that have taken a little longer. As we have talked through both our strategy for the university generally and also plans in the university around those particular issues. And through those conversations, which have been part of a larger strategic process in the university, I have been very grateful to this man, I have to say, because just as he stands over this event, he stood over our shoulders, keeping us honest. Throughout the conversations, it would come back as a refrain. This is the university that Charles Perkins chose to attend, and we have an obligation to honour that legacy. We are very fortunate to be able to say that we are the university of the first Indigenous graduate in Australia, and we have a duty to make sure that we are true to that tradition, that we build on the choice that he made. Well, I say he stood over our shoulder, but I was extremely fortunate. We were extremely fortunate that it wasn't actually a conversation that it was difficult to muster enthusiasm for. Because across the faculties of the university, there was a sense in this conversation that we needed to do this better, that we needed both better to think about supporting Indigenous researchers in particular, and also that we needed to think hard about the issue of Indigenous education in Indigenous issues for non-Indigenous students, if we were to take the claim seriously that we were an Australian university. And that wasn't in any way to diminish the remarkable work of the Koori Centre or Yurungurung or the people who had been supporting Indigenous students here at the university, but it was to say, this is actually an issue of strategic importance for the university as a whole if we're together going to know what it means to be an Australian university and a university that is fortunate enough to have the Perkins tradition located here. So this is an important evening, an annual evening in the life of the university. It makes me as Vice Chancellor, and I know it makes the staff of the university think, well, how far have we come this year? Are we a university that is more open to the Indigenous community, both within the university and outside the university, than we were last year? Are we doing a better job across these range of issues? Well, this year we have made some real progress. There are some announcements we're going to make soon, and I think that will be an even bigger step forward. But as I say, in all of that, I'm grateful to him, and I'm grateful for the sense that we must keep faithful to the tradition that by his bravery in choosing this as a place to become a student in, that we remain faithful to the challenge that he set us the day that he arrived here. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. Let me briefly set the scene for the oration. If Charles is looking over our shoulder, if you can feel his spirit with us here this evening, what would he think needs to be said to close that space between us and to move forward? Because a great Indigenous man would truly understand in this hour that perhaps only a great Indigenous woman can really gauge how much hurt has been inflicted by the recent policy of assimilation, racism, and terrible neglect. We have a great Indigenous woman to give this oration. A descendant of the Miriam people from the Torres Strait, she trained as a social worker, has a doctorate from the ANU in human ecology. Two words that barely touch the sides of how much Kerry Arabina understands and how many different Indigenous people she truly has listened to become knowledgeable of all the things that can bring us towards well-being for all Australian people. She has a depth of experience in public health, social justice, human rights, gender issues, prevention of violence, and all of those interconnected things that can destroy us. But on the other hand, she's worked hard to look at those things that can put individuals, families, whole communities, and even our nation together. It's the knowledge that makes us strong and smart, that makes us a nation that values every one of our citizens. This gifted Indigenous leader has educated herself to listen to people, not only those who we read about or are in those government reports, but the forgotten, marginalised lives in our cities, in our suburbs, and in the far-flung remote communities. Kerry Arabina has had experience in the Northern Territory and in far north Queensland, and has worked on a whole range of programs across Australian life at this complex challenge that really is summed up by inequality, the unfinished business, the injustice that we have not yet dealt with. She's the CEO of the Lowitja Institute and the co-chair of the new National Congress of Australian First Peoples. Please welcome for the 10th anniversary oration, Dr. Kerry Arabina.
Oops. I acknowledge the traditional owners on the country on where we're meeting tonight, the Gadigal peoples of the Eora Nation. I pay respects to your elders and to those who come before us. I wish to thank you, Chikamadan, for your generous welcome to country and acknowledge the Perkins family. And my fellow board members on the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, my families and friends. I would also like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Dr. Michael Spence, the Vice-Chancellor and Principal of the Sydney University, Dr. Jeff McMullen for his introduction, and Ms. Janet Moody from the Koori Centre for the great honour and privilege of being invited to address you here tonight in memory of a truly great Australian leader and Wadi Pulka, Charles Perkins. Before I get to the body of my speech, I'd like to talk about the person who has made tonight possible. In a life of exceptional achievement, Charles Perkins demonstrated that passionate engagement in the injustices affecting our lives is rarely neat and tidy. He was a brilliant man, but often in strife and largely misunderstood. But nothing great in the world has ever been achieved without passion. Charles Perkins, supported by his family, I believe, achieved dimensions of greatness. A rebel free thinker, a restless spirit, son, husband, father and grandfather, a man capable of looking far into the future and even further into the past, who dared challenge the precepts that Australians hold most dear and in doing so personalised for all of us our quest for equality. I remember vividly the first time I met Charlie. It was at Kintore, 600 kilometres west of Alice Springs. I was 21, the administrator at the Pinterby Homelands Health Service, and Charlie dropped out of the sky in a single-engine aeroplane and was doing a consultation. I could not believe that in a red, dusty, windy place, complete with the leather-backed dogs all cruising everywhere, there, at the front of the council office, was the most immaculately dressed man that I had ever seen. He also had the shiniest shoes. Now, when my father was 21, he did a stint at T.C. Burns, which is a shop, and he was a shoe seller. He always told me that you could tell the calibre of a man by the shine in his shoes. Well, my opinion of Charles then went off the Richter scale. I was completely fixated. The second time I met Charlie, I was working in Cape York, the executive director at the Cape York Health Council. I went up and fearfully introduced myself to him at a conference. Charles finished off our brief conversation by calling me a champion. A what? I couldn't believe it. He was the champion of Aboriginal affairs calling me a champion. You're a champion, mate, just keep going. A phrase he would use with many of us. And didn't that just want to make us keep going too? There were plenty of opportunities in my life just to stop, just to settle for a satisfying yet bland life. But people like Charlie were looking for champions who were going to take it forward. Champions for the cause, champions on the sports field, champions in our families, champions in politics. Champions who felt destined to unite people who had become separated. Champions who dared to dream for equality and justice. Charlie was compelled and compelled others to have the next big dream or possibility, then make it happen. Charles Perkins asked us all to find the champion within, and amazingly, he could already see us all as champions. It was up to us to realise it. No excuses. If he were here today, I imagine that he would be interested in who our new champions are, what their vehicle for change will be, and what vision they should hold for all of us to aspire to. He would be interested to know if the modern-day champions had forgotten or built on the experiences of those who had gone on before us, who used grassroots organisations, or who had been part of FACATSIA, DAA or NAC, then NACC and ADSIC, and whether we had learned the lessons from those and incorporated them into the new. I can say with absolute certainty and pride that all of the architects of the road ahead are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have heeded that call of Charlie's. Who among us are champions? Who among us dares to find, then follow that champion within? And we have answered. Tonight I will be discussing the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, the most recent addition to the national self-determining infrastructure set up to deliver that promise that Charlie and others have fought so hard for, that we are all equal, all free, and all deserving of a chance to pursue our opportunity and experience happiness. The title of my talk is Vetting Vehicles and Vision. Vetting because we have responded to the community's request for high, uncompromising standard. Vehicle because the Congress, I believe, has the capacity to influence what all Australians can do, and vision because it can become a beacon for years to come. I stand here tonight, as all the board members and staff of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples do. We are humbled by the task before us. We are grateful for the trust bestowed upon us by our peers and colleagues, mindful of the intelligence given and sacrifices borne by our ancestors. We consider ourselves champions, not because we are big noters, but because we are in service to more than 300 nations of Australia's First Peoples across this vast continent and to our nation, Australia. Our service makes us champions, men like Charlie wanted us to be. When we signed up to be part of the National Congress, we knew that we were part of the next wave of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people seeking to redress inequality, to redress injustice to achieve equality. We knew we were aiming to achieve full citizenship rights and to act on the responsibilities those rights entail within our own Indigenous societies and within the wider Australian society. And we seek these things not simply because of the expectations that those in government might have for us, but because we, the people, have remained faithful to those citizenship ideals of our forebearers and true to their aspirations while realising our own. So it has always been in our communities, and so it must remain. As company directors, we needed to be prepared to stand up, and as one great leader said, choose hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. As we consider the road that unfolds before us now, we, the board, also remember with humble gratitude those courageous advocates from within our past and within our communities who at this very hour are also working to realise our rights in urban areas, in our organisations, community halls, in rural communities, on country, around kitchen tables and across cultures. These advocates have something to tell us all. Those in our past whisper through the ages. Those in communities through conversations. They provide us with an instruction on what to safeguard, what to be a custodian of for this part of the journey, and how to achieve our rights, and how to embody the spirit of service. I find for myself the more I am open to these instructions, the more I am willing to find meaning in something greater than myself and by my individual effort alone. So not for profit, not for personal gain, but because I value who we are as First Nations peoples, where we have come from and all we can be if we're given the opportunity. At the commencement of the 21st century, members of the board are mindful of the fact that we are looking to secure our First Peoples' economic, environmental, social and cultural futures in an unprecedented time of change in the history of the world. Achievements in science, technology, industry, commerce and finance have brought humans into a new age at the expense of much of the diversity of life and life-enhancing processes around the world. Demographically, we have the largest number of ever adolescents in the history of our species, many of whom are living in poverty. India and China are becoming the most powerful, technologically advanced countries in the world. Globalised multinational companies have budgets bigger than some countries. Our country is at war. That we are in the midst of a crisis is now well understood. Not only do we have to consider international and Asia-Pacific regional issues in our deliberations, but domestic issues as well. In Australia, it appears that natural and cultural diversity is not viewed as a source of wealth, nor a resource for modernity, nor for current political models. Indeed, even within the 600,000 people who are the First Peoples of Australia, we find it difficult to view our own diversity with the respect it deserves, let alone get respect from others. Australia is governed by a federal parliament that only has one Aboriginal member. We see a system of service delivery to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people by governments at both federal and state levels that still struggles to deliver the most basic of services that benefit Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We see a system that does not want us to be decision makers, one with too many bureaucrats who do not see themselves as accountable to our people or as having responsibilities to ensure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people benefit from their efforts. And we have seen limited engagement with our people in the setting of policy and programs. We are still not fully engaged with the system of a real economy, nor do some of us live in places where a buoyant market economy exists. Our life expectancy, while improving, is happening at a glacial pace. We are all not benefiting from the delivery of education. Our own knowledge systems are still marginalised, and sadly, we still remain overrepresented in judicial and child protection systems. These systemic issues themselves are indicators of crisis, evidenced by data and statistics. Less measurable but no less profound is the impact of a sapping of confidence in and by our communities, a nagging fear that failure is inevitable and that the next generation must lower its sights. A subtle message is inherent: give up before it hurts too much. These and other circumstances are unacceptable and form part of the reasoning why a national representative body like the Congress is needed. In this century, our challenges will be new. Instruments with which we meet these challenges will also be new. But those values upon which our traditional societies were built and upon which our success as countrymen and women depend, discipline and community, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and love of country, these things are old. These things are true. They have been the quiet force of progress and given hope, even when there was no hope apparent. These values have been evident throughout history and the mainstay of our culture. These values have underpinned our resilience when all other indicators suggested that we should falter. What is demanded then is a return to the truth and certainty of these values. They contain in them the responsibilities and a recognition on part of every single Australian that we have duties to ourselves as First Peoples and as a nation. Duties that Barack Obama said in his inauguration speech, we do not grudgingly accept, but gladly seize, in the firm knowledge that there is nothing so satisfying to the spirit, so defining of our character, than giving our all to a difficult task. We who assume leadership roles in our communities and organisations know probably more than most that this is both the price and the promise of citizenship. I know that our members are clear about the challenges we face as First Peoples and that they are real. They are serious and they are many. We have told community people that these challenges will not be easily met or within a short space of time. This is why the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples has been established as an independent organisation intent on creating a legacy. The Congress is a long-term proposition, evolving and changing with input from our membership. I am proud that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been the architects, the designers, the campaigners, the consultants, the doers, the makers, the choosers, the facilitators, the explainers and the implementers of this new national representative voice. We have built the organisations on elements that have worked well in ATSIC and other national representative bodies, and we have used company law to allow for more entrepreneurial thinking and action. We are innovators concerned with establishing a foundation of greatness, not as a given, but as a greatness which is earned. Greatness through the Congress will not occur because we have taken shortcuts or settled for less. We have decided that this will not be an organisation which supports those who prefer leisure over work, or be a platform for those whose criminal behaviour or lack of regard for others will bring the organisation into disrepute, nor is the National Congress for those who seek only the seduction of personal fame. Rather, this organisation will be represented by the culturally strong, the educated, the risk-takers, the doers, the makers of things, men and women who have laboured unknown but appreciated in our communities, who have delivered a legacy for those working for equality and freedom. This decision about who represent us is conceived in the ideal of not who is the strongest or the loudest, but assessing who among us is worthy of commanding the right use of strength and resource to see change happen where and when it is most needed. In these times, the leadership question can only be answered by those who command it. Not everyone in this audience or in other audiences I have addressed will have the pleasure of being an artist or a poet, a doctor or a teacher. Not everyone will know the simple beauty of love, either given or received. It is a truth, however, that everyone will come upon some form of hardship, of pain and struggle, of adversity. In fact, for some of us, it is the only constant in our lives. We will make all decisions that affect our lives to those close to us and possibly even following generations. It is during these times of adversity that we turn to people who command leadership, who can articulate the ideals and principles that allow us to rally behind them. They must also be able to marshal resources with great effect. All our leaders at this time in history, all of our leaders, will need to have integrity, determination, charisma, vision, technical and interpersonal expertise, adaptability, and the even often overlooked quality of being an experienced follower. All of these characteristics are crucial to helping us deal with and to successfully come through this particular time of adversity. We need leaders who can command power and resources to great effect to stand up and come forward now. It is your time. Leadership needs to contribute to something bigger than the sum of all of our individual ambition and be greater than all of the difference of birth, community, or faction. Leaders cannot be seen to be protecting narrow interests nor put off unpleasant decisions. Surely that time has passed. There are many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might find themselves in poverty and who might find my assertions of leadership outside of their realm of influence. For some people, poverty is what they live and breathe, and I'm not talking just about financial poverty. I'm also talking about being impoverished culturally, linguistically, those who are time poor, isolated, without love, women growing up children without partners, educationally impoverished, children growing up in institutions rather than in the care of a family. There are many ways to be impoverished. Poverty is a human rights issue after all. Some of us can move out of that circumstance, and some of us will die in it. And whilst our effort should be to engage with and direct resources to people in poverty, we do have cause for celebration. Among our number are professors, lawyers, barristers, judges, teachers, health workers, doctors, nurses, academics, politicians, dancers, athletes, public servants, people who are trained in governance, business, entrepreneurial thinkers and actors. We have people in decision-making and powerful positions. We have chief executives, chairmen and women. We have marine biologists, social scientists, rangers, researchers. We have people working in corrections, youth agencies, as lecturers, representing us locally, nationally and internationally. We have all done our teething in health, education, academia, natural resource management, in regional autonomy, leadership development, organisational management, youth empowerment, media marketing and public policy, land purchasing, business development, economic development, human rights and political strategy. We're amazing. We must also celebrate those that have kept their children and families alive despite the great challenges in their lives and those who have helped them thrive. Some of us have been working in our affairs now for at least 20 years and are in positions to mentor others. We are the emergent leadership and we will be taken notice of. This type of leadership is now critical for all of our affairs because the issues affecting our health and well-being are globalised and localised, so be assured. If you have got In my view, a criminal record for a Category A crime, including rape or murder, you will never represent Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through the National Congress. If you have committed fraud and been found guilty, don't even put your hand up to represent us. If during your term you behave in a way that brings the organisation into disrepute and there is evidence to support it, we will get rid of you. If you are disrespectful to another representative, you will be disciplined, and if it continues, you will be gone. If you're a wrecker and can't build a legacy for the National Congress, you are not needed. You will not be welcomed. You will not be supported through this organisation. Of course, not everyone joining the National Congress wants to be a leader or a representative. Some just want their voices heard. Some want to belong to something bigger than themselves and their personal circumstance. And there is a place for them in the Congress. If you are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander over the age of 18, then there is a Congress membership card with your name on it waiting for you. You can be a prisoner in Long Bay, a single parent living in a caravan park in Tingalpa outside of Brisbane. You can own two properties in Darwin and have a stock portfolio. You can be a business owner and employ 8 people. You can be going to university or work as a ranger. You can be on a welfare benefit. You can be on the pension. You can be a traditional owner or a member of the Stolen Generations. There are only 4 criteria to satisfy in order to become a Congress member. You must be over 18, have the heritage, you must identify and be accepted by your community. This is a self-declaring process. The National Board of the Congress are not identity police. We have told people during our consultations that the membership form is a legally binding document. If they cannot satisfy the criteria, then there are legal ramifications for falsifying information. In terms of the organisations seeking to be members, agencies need to have at least 51% of their members in a board be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, and the principal purpose of the organisation needs to be in service to our communities. After a particularly difficult day earlier this year, I had the opportunity to open the mail. There were envelopes of all different shapes and sizes, carefully scripted envelopes with large and clear writing, many with returned addresses on the back. These envelopes contained membership forms, some sent in from the Koori Mail, some photocopied, others were the originals that we had just taken out with us across the country. Some, well, I don't know how people came across them except to say that we blackfellas have very well-developed networks. What heartened me on that particular afternoon as I opened these envelopes, that there were application forms from members of entire families, all stapled together. Other application forms were from older members of our communities with little handwritten notes inside of congratulations. Others were sent in with messages that they were also getting encouraging other people to join up, and we were getting 50 or so from their community. This meant so much to me, helped me believe that we were building something of which we could all be proud. Others reported their ambassador status. Congress ambassadors who have taken the forms, distributed them, helped people fill them out, made the cups of tea, told the stories of hope, stood up as an advocate and remobilised our peoples. Those ambassadors never, ever have questioned the scale of our ambition. They have never forgotten what we as First Peoples have already done and achieved. What they believe in unquestioningly and without need for detailed information is that in this country we are free men and women who can achieve anything we want. And by choosing the Congress, those ambassadors know that what we can make happen when imagination is joined to common purpose and the necessity to courage. And they are already waiting for whatever that means. By extending the opportunity to belong to the Congress, to be a member, I think is a small act of greatness in itself. Perhaps this is why just 5 months after hiring our first staff member, we have almost 1,200 individual memberships, and among them also 100 organisations. Through our membership, we are structuring both belonging and opportunity, not because it is charitable or we need to get the numbers to be legitimate, but because we believe that the Congress provides a different way for people to be drawn together in coherent and stably organised political communities. It is one of the surest routes to our common good, and our common good is too precious to be undone by the illegal behaviours of a few. We want to be judged for what we build, not for what we destroy. We cannot support those who are only powerful through acts of corruption or deceit, or have perpetrated suffering for which they have been charged. We have listened to a number of key concerns from community people and have turned them into a vetting system. The first concern was that the Congress had representation that was fit and proper. The second was that people wanted to be safe. Women didn't want to be in the same room with perpetrators of violence, for example. The third concern was that there needed to be a mechanism to use in the event that a director of the company or a member of the Congress behaved improperly, for which there was a legal conviction, and that the members themselves could participate in a process to effect a representative's removal from office. Finally, it was said during the community consultations that the organisation had to be completely independent from government and that all measures had to be taken that would protect the organisation. We have covered off against these concerns in our vetting process. Adjudication in matters brought by the members, vetting the delegates to the Congress and ensuring appropriate development and maintenance of standards for the National Congress is to be achieved in partnership with the Ethics Council, an independent advisory body comprised of eminent people. No other company in Australian ASIC law has developed such a mechanism. The Ethics Council applied a merit-based selection process to shortlist candidates for the current national board and will be instrumental in applying the standard to elect candidates for the representative roles of the Congress delegates, directors and co-chairs. All members who nominate to be representatives will have to pass a federal police check and meet fit and proper criteria developed by the Ethics Council. The Ethics Council will then be responsible for ensuring the ethical conduct of representatives of the organisation based on the Nolan Principles of Public Office. The Ethics Council has six of our own people of high standing with co-chairs and a gender balance amongst their members. The Council will initially serve a two-year term in order to bed down the processes for the new organisation, and additionally they will advise on standards and guidelines and assist with legal and reporting requirements, investigate breaches or complaints and review any queries about eligibility for membership. The inclusion of the Ethics Council into the Constitution of the Congress and giving them a charter that defines their roles and responsibilities has been a source of comfort for many community people, but it has also been a source of contestation. Who are these people? How come they have the power to veto me? I thought this organisation was going to be representative of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. How come I can get kicked out through this process? The truth is that anyone and everyone who meets the criteria to be a member can be a member. Members can and will be asked for their advice on policies and approaches to issues that affect their lives. Members can attend forums and be invited to participate at Congress-sponsored events. No member will be subject to a vetting process until they want to be a representative. Similar processes are in place if people want to work with youth, to be a politician, work in schools or be members of company boards. For the first time, however, we are bringing vetting processes into an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representative organisation, and this is a change, but it's what is needed in my view, not only to protect values in a world hostile to such values, but to ensure that we can fully get behind and protect those who want to represent us. Such is the sacredness with which I have come to view the Congress. My view was further deepened earlier this year when Noel Pearson referred to the National Congress as a wailing wall for blackfellas' victimisation. I think I know what he was getting at. He seemed to want to sideline the National Congress. His throwaway line was included in no less than 10 newspaper articles and many blogs in Australia and internationally as a reason to not get behind us, deeming it unworthy of support. Now, I also know that Noel would not want to offend people from the Jewish or Muslim faiths, but the Wailing Wall is a central tenet of a practice of faith for millions of people across the world. It is a place of communion, thought sacred because it's where God resides on earth, and in my view, not to be trivialised. Praying at the wall signifies being in the presence of the divine. People have made pilgrimages to the Wailing Wall for centuries, leaving notes of hope in the cracks of the wall. It has been a place of grief and struggle, a place of reconciliation and of truth and purpose and faith. The Wailing Wall is no less significant to those millions of people because one person in a throwaway line is seeking a little win, chose to make it so. I am a person of great faith. I have been on a pilgrimage. As a Torres Strait Islander, I know what it means to stand on the sacred soil of my ancestral home, my Gid. It is a heartfelt hope of mine that the National Congress could inspire the same faith, hope, and sense of sacredness in the lives of our people as the Wailing Wall. And so what can the National Congress be a vehicle for? The primary objective of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples is to reconnect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with the decision-making structures in this country, providing its members with the opportunity to be informed and to have input about decisions that are affecting their lives. Prior to the establishment of the National Congress and since the abolition of ATSIC, we have not had a national voice which could harness the collective energies and efforts of individuals and communities. This is the first time that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people ourselves have had the opportunity to shape a national representative voice in ways to ensure the views and aspirations of our peoples are taken into account. International evidence has shown it is clear an essential ingredient in overcoming disadvantage is the close, respected involvement of the community itself. In this vein, I want to identify five opportunities that the Congress can be a vehicle for. The first is setting the standards for engagement in communities. Now, I don't do this very often, but I was freaked out the other day. In having a discussion with government representatives, they informed me that as soon as we opened our doors for business, there would be policy documents to review and new directions to endorse. Whilst the Congress is there to monitor and evaluate the performance of government and government agencies, we are not there to tick a box or to become an extension of government, nor are we a substitute for real and local consultation. There are a great number of peak bodies and agencies that do develop policy work and have effective partnerships with government and businesses already at the state, national and international forums. We will not be usurping their role. Rather, we will be supporting their key as organisations that have a key role in policy input and advice. Perhaps what the Congress may see in future is to set an equivalent of a Heart Foundation tick, a standard that will articulate uncompromising standards about how to do business. The second opportunity for which the Congress can be a vehicle is about us having to participate in parliamentary processes. The National Congress is not an instrument of government. It is a representative voice for people who feel that they may not have access to parliamentary processes at local, state and national levels. In order to redress this in a generation, the issues we face, we will need to form relationships with parliamentarians across all parties and across all Australia. We want to do something that has not been possible so far by forming parliamentary and select committees with interested senators and ministers in federal and state parliaments. We want to address issues of concern as expert advisers, using United Nations models on how to inform this process. Our members have asked us to push for seats in Parliament like the Maori people do. As such, we want to assist in the parliamentary commitment to referendums and constitutional reform. The third is the opportunity for which the Congress can be a vehicle is to ensure that the United Nations Declarations for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is implemented. The United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples will provide us with an important tool in how we could move forward together. The Declaration is a self-determination in practice. The Declaration affirms that we are the First Peoples and that we have a role and a responsibility and a unique contribution to the diversity and richness of civilisations and cultures. The Congress can facilitate public discussions about the Declaration and how it should be implemented. The fourth opportunity for which the Congress can be a vehicle is about harnessing collective voice and action. At a local level, we have long said that we cannot look at diabetes without first having more houses. We have said in health, for example, is healing one body part, and you can't heal the whole body. Healing one body part won't heal the whole body, nor will one organisation be able to make all the changes that are needed. Rather, change will be as the result of agencies working together, bringing in a diversity of thought, experience and collective action. We have said we need to focus on wholes rather than parts, to build relationships rather than to separate entities, and to understand networks and feedback loops rather than assume that linear deterministic cause and effect influences prevail. In this context, then, leadership and influence takes on quite different connotations. The incongruence and inadequacy of equating leader to position, to level or to title becomes obvious. These are all static designations. They cannot reflect the ongoing flow of reality for Australia's First Peoples. There are four ways in which we'll focus on harnessing that collective voice in action for the members of the Congress. The first way recognises our unique gifts of all of the members and the responsibility to contribute those unique gifts and to invite the contribution of others. In this way, the Congress is not just about those with university degrees. Every member has the ability to influence the environment of the Congress so that all voices feel welcomed, to demonstrate personal integrity that creates trust, to contribute to continual well-being of the membership in the Congress. The second way is to support the work already being done by peak agencies across Australia, many of whom work in land, health rights, housing, child protection, who are professional associations, and on other emergent issues. These agencies have supported their membership with the development of key policies and issues papers, and the National Congress will rather support than replicate the work of these agencies. The third way will be to encourage a cross-agency portfolio approach to particular issues. I, for example, would be interested to see how the issue of teenage pregnancy could be better dealt with. The perverse and negative incentives are very powerful. The receipt of baby money, the lack of buoyant market economies, the transitions between year 10 and 11 and year 12 in university or employment, access to public housing and a higher amount of money in the welfare payments, entrapment, the way young people are socialised, the use of alcohol and drugs, young women's empowerment or not, sexual education and reproductive health all contribute to how teenage pregnancy comes to be. But what could happen if members invested in health, housing, education, land rights, economic development, and traditional owners, parents and young peoples could dialogue around this and other issues? What would happen then if the Congress wrote a paper that was inclusive of the diversity of people's lived experiences and was able to express what should happen in those instances with clarity, opportunity and purpose? Who would listen to our collective voice and enable that connection action? Would you? The fourth way we are harnessing this collective voice is through the membership fully participating in a democratic model and exercising the right to vote. We are implementing a model that will allow each and every one of them to have a say in who gets to lead them. And this is critical to ensure the National Congress facilitates the right to democracy and the full participation in democratic processes by its members. This is not a one-man band or a closed shop. This is a people's movement. A voice, and we will be heard. The fifth and final opportunity for which the Congress can be a vehicle is about facilitating the respectful generation and contribution to knowledge across the world. On June 11, 1776, while the question of independence was being debated by the founding fathers of America, the visiting Iroquois chiefs were formally invited into the meeting hall of the Continental Congress. There was a speech delivered in which they were addressed as brothers and told the delegates' wish that friendship between them would continue as long as the sun shall shine and the waters flow. The speech also expressed the hope that new Americans and the Iroquois act as one people and have but one heart. With the Iroquois chiefs inside the hall of the Congress on the eve of the American independence, the impact of those ideals on the founders is unmistakable. And so too will the National Congress seek to influence the respectful generation and contribution of Australia's First Peoples' knowledges between each other in this country and the world. This will be done in several ways, through meetings and forums at conferences, seminars, and in sessions with our members. There will be the facilitation of task-orientated groups interest groups, organised protest and participation in discussions. We'll also use social networking, digital and web-based methods of generating information for the public and for members. And we will have scholarships for people to attend such meetings when possible. We will have scholarships for people to participate in the first Congress as part of their postgraduate degrees. Finally, let me come now to my final V, the vision for the Congress. Some visions, not all, have to start with an apology, or rather an ask for forgiveness and a remembrance. In stating what the vision of the Congress is, I'll both apologise and ask for forgiveness first, and then remember. The National Congress will not be able to save more marriages. We're not going to be there to visit the homebound. We'll not be able to ease the pain of parents who have lost a child. We will not have money to help widows, single parents or families in economic ruin. We will not be able to spend specific time teaching young people, nor will we be able to come into everyone's workplace and assist them, or visit them on country, or heal those who have been part of the stolen generations, lived in institutions. Nor will we be able to make peace for peoples whose heart is full of hate. The National Congress, with its staff of 22, board of 8, and delegates numbering 120, will not be able to do these things in the way that we should. We simply won't be there, personally, to stop the violence, to stop the hurt, to ease the pain, to celebrate, to witness, to ensure in a personal way the dignity and kindness that should be afforded to each and every person in Australia. It is not possible that any of us as individuals or as the Board of Congress can do that for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. For these shortcomings, we ask for forgiveness. But what we can draw on is our own experiences and our own aspirations and make a vision for the Congress from that point. For me, this is the remembrance. I remember so clearly the young woman I was 23 years ago, a mother for a month, a teenager and a first-year university student living in a caravan, isolated from everything and everyone. I recall one day where I'd yet again been flogged quite badly, and I noticed afterwards that the fan I had for my new baby-born son had been ripped out of the wall and the prongs were still in the socket. I reached over to pull them out absent-mindedly and ended up getting a nasty electric shock which threw me against the wall opposite. Now, this was one incident of many that I endured for years, but eventually I had the strength to walk away, and 23 years later, here I am. Everything I do in this Congress, I do for the me I was 23 years ago. It is her I have in mind when I present, when I visit community people, when I devise some strategies that might establish a vision for this organisation. If this Congress is capable of reaching her, of engaging her, representing her, then in my view we will have succeeded. So the first element of the vision is that we will be capable of engaging those with whom no one else can. The second element of the vision is about our members, that we will grow and change as a result of input and advice from them, so that we are representing them in ways which they both need and can take pride. The result of this member-driven evolution does have implications for the board. For example, our members informed us that they needed more time to consider becoming a delegate than the Congress than we had given them, and we listened. This means that the first National Congress will be delivered in the first part of next year, not later this year as we originally planned. The third element of the vision is necessarily focused on re-engaging Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with the decision-making processes in this country. It might mean that we end up with an administration arm and a political party arm. It might mean that we establish a precedent in Parliament by participating in a joint committee or a standing committee or having a seat at COAG. The fourth element of the vision has to do with who represents us, both now and into the future. We all, as Australians, have a duty to properly mentor Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people into these roles so that support them in the uptake and the responsibilities with maturity, in compassion for what is at hand, a vision and a sense of purpose, and an unwavering conviction in the possibilities of collaboration, partnership, and unity. The fifth element of the vision focuses on the larger threats to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country and indeed the world. I had one of the most enduring instructions in my life from Mate James Rice, one of the four defendants in the Mabo case. 16 years after the court case was won, we went back and interviewed him about what he was achieved. He said with tears in his eyes, "I did what I did not just for the Rice family, nor for Murray Islanders or for Torres Strait Islanders, or even just Australians. I did this for people around the world. And so my instruction is this, we must always see the global and the local. Being true to this instruction, then, I will always be compelled by my personal view that the deepest cause of devastation to our First People and our globe is found in a mode of consciousness that has established a radical discontinuity between human beings, other species we share this planet with, and the ecosystems that supports our lives. This attitude permeates four of the fundamental establishments that control the human realm: governments, corporations, universities and religions, the political, economic, intellectual and religious establishments of our time. The National Congress has a role and a responsibility to shake these establishments to their very roots with all the passion and hope that we can muster, not only for ourselves but for all people everywhere in every single circumstance. The full vision for the Congress is the same as it should be for all of our institutions everywhere. Our vision is that the full fluorescence of the world in all of its magnificence is here for future generations. And we will carry out the improvement in the circumstance of our lives, and we can be part of the global infrastructure that facilitates a transition from a period of human devastation of First Peoples and the Earth to a period of time when all humans are present to the planet in a mutually beneficial manner. Such a transition has no human historical parallel. Humans prior were not dealing with anything comparable to the toxins in the air, the water, the soil, or with the immense volumes of chemicals dispersed throughout the planet. Nor were they dealing with the extinction of species or the altering of climate on a scale such as our present concern. In order to ensure the planet is available for future generations, we have to draw on our older knowledge traditions and provide advice on how to live in the very structure and functioning of the planet itself. I'm nearly finished. History is governed by those overarching moments that give shape and meaning to life by relating human venture to the larger destinies of the planet. Creating such a work might be called the great work of a people. The National Congress is not only our great work, it is our vehicle for great work, something that we can find inspirational and inspire people around the world. Each of us have our own individual life patterns and responsibilities. Yet, beyond these concerns, each person in and through their personal work contributes to the great work. We cannot doubt that we have been given the intellectual vision, the spiritual insight, and even the physical resources we need for carrying out this transition, such as it is demanded in these times. Mutual enhancement is the complete vision of the National Congress. It is a long-term proposition, and there is much work to be done. So to bring this to the close, I have offered my ideas tonight to both provoke and stimulate. I think we've seen how provocative some of those ideas can be. I have talked about how we have come to be a National Congress by listening to our past and imagining a future. I have talked about the champions past and present and the way in which our members are coming to us because the imagined future is shared. I have discussed the five ways in which the Congress will be a vehicle for what we, the people, want to achieve, and I've talked about what it is to have a vision to be, yet knowing we cannot be all things to all people. We are indeed fortunate to have the National Congress, not only to rebuild our relationships based on mutual respect, but for what it provides as a vehicle to assist the planet and with all whom we share this common lived experience. All that I have offered here tonight has been offered constructively and in a spirit of reconciliation and to honour the legacy of the great Charlie Perkins. From self-respect comes dignity, and from dignity comes hope. My friends and colleagues and fellow board members, We have hopes in spades, and I have plenty in my heart tonight. And this hope is for us all, because when the world quiets to the sound of our own breathing, we all want the same things: comfort, love, and a peaceful heart. So I hope that each and every one here tonight heeds Charlie's call and looks for the inner champion that we have inside all of us. Take care. Much, much love, and travel well. And thank you so, so very much for listening. Au revoir.
Thank you, Kerry, for your honesty, your strength, and the vision you've shared with us. But on behalf of the Sydney University, please welcome the Director of the Currie Centre, Janet Mooney.
And I've got the wrong glasses on. Okay, sorry for that. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, elders past and present, and extend my acknowledgement to the other Indigenous people with us tonight. It's wonderful to see so many people here tonight, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, who have come along to celebrate this very important occasion, the 10th anniversary of Charles Perkins' annual memorial oration, and to listen to our speaker's thoughts on the National Congress of Australia's First People. On behalf of the Currie Centre, the Vice-Chancellor and Principal, Dr. Michael Spence, and the University, I'm honoured to give our vote of thanks for Dr. Kerry Arabina. Kerry has acknowledged the great work of Charles Perkins. He was truly a champion and a great leader. Two major attributes which Kerry has identified as essential for the board members and staff of the National Congress of Australia's First People. Kerry's reminded us that in a changing global world, that we need national leaders and advocates who are proactive in advancing the Indigenous cause. She acknowledges that although the Congress should be engaged in alleviating poverty, we should not forget the strengths in our communities. In essence, Kerry has highlighted that if we wish to create a country where Indigenous people have the same range of opportunities and choices available to them as non-Indigenous people, we need a strong, committed, national, collective voice. She has importantly stressed that this voice needs to be led by committed and strong people, people who have integrity, leadership qualities, and are champions within our community. As Kerry states, the Congress is a long-term proposition, evolving and changing with the input of its members. I believe that being a member of the Congress is an exciting prospect as it brings Indigenous people together to form a coherent, stable position through an ever-changing political environment. Kerry's address has emphasised the importance of honesty, mutual respect, equal opportunity, and the ability to make a positive and enduring difference with a vehicle that has a common purpose. Thank you, Kerry, for being part of our very special occasion. And I now like to present you with a gift and appreciation for your contribution to this evening's event. If you could come up, please, Kerry.
beautiful. This is love. Here we go. The long and the short of it. I think I'm going to put you on some stairs here. Thank you so very much.
That's right.
It now gives me great pleasure to announce the recipients of this year's Dr. Charles Perkins Memorial Prize. This prize was established in 2000 to commemorate the lifelong achievements of Dr. Perkins, the first Indigenous Australian graduate of the University of Sydney. Since 2003, through contributions from the university and Charles Perkins Trust for Children and Students, the prize has been awarded to three Indigenous Australian students who have completed a bachelor or honours degree and have achieved outstanding results during their studies. I now invite the Vice Chancellor and Hetty Perkins to join me to present the prizes. Okay, our first recipient for 2010 is Amanda Porter. Can you please come up, Amanda? I now invite Amanda to say a few words.
I'd also like to acknowledge that we're meeting on Gadigal land and to pay my respects to the elders past and present. I'm wearing a dress tonight that I made for a course at the Koori Centre in 2008. I call it my family frock, and it's my attempt to express my own sense of identity and belonging. With that said, I'd like to thank my family who've travelled to be here this afternoon, including my granddad, Don Ferguson, who's come down. I'd also like to thank Dr. Thalia Anthony for her inspiration and time. Working as a research assistant for her gave me the confidence to get through my studies. Thank you to the hardworking and dedicated staff at the Koori Centre, and thank you very much to the Perkins family. I feel that there are many others who are more deserving of this award, so I'm very humbled to accept it tonight. Thank you.
The second prize is awarded to Rebecca O'Brien. I now invite Rebecca to say a few words.
I'd also like to begin by acknowledging that we stand here today on the Gadigal people's land, and thank you for your welcome to your country. I'd also like to thank the Perkins family. Your continuing dedication to Indigenous education constantly astounds and amazes me, and I don't think that it's something that we see nearly enough today. Thank you so much, Janet and the Koori Centre, for this award. I'd really like to be able to say that I think that I've earned it on my own, but to be honest, as an Indigenous graduate, I know that for every congratulations that you're offered, you owe about another 10 thank yous. So I thought that tonight would be a really good opportunity to offer just a few of these. Thank you to my family, my mum and my dad. Your encouragement is the reason why I'm here. You always taught me that education was the most important thing that I can do. Not to go out and get a good job and make a lot of money, but because you wanted me to be able to do what I love. And I can honestly stand here today and say to you now that I am. And without you and without your love and support, I wouldn't be here. To everyone at the Koori Centre, what can I say? The support that you offer us goes above and beyond what anyone could expect, financial support being the very least. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Tanya. What you do for us is beyond description. I simply don't know where we'd be without you. To my friends at the Koori Centre, Nathan, Charlotte, Narelle and Craig, you guys kept me about as sane as a person possibly could be doing their honours year. You stuck through my late night rants and tantrums, and you were always there with words of encouragement whenever I needed them. And finally, to Janet, our director, I don't think that we'd have the centre that we do without you. You're behind everything that we have. Thank you. And finally, I'd like to thank my other friends who have seen me through, Alice and Eric, and everybody else at the University of Sydney Union. You guys have made a home for me here. I came here not knowing a single person, and although I doubt many people would believe this today, I spent most of my first year too terrified to speak to anyone. It was the union that brought me out. You guys have made the last 4 years of my life the absolute best. Finally, one last thanks. Tristan Enright, what can I say? The hours and hours that we spend over coffee and beer talking about everything from our respective honours to now our PhD theses, to the latest series of Beauty and the Geek, and how we know that we'll be changing the future of sociology very soon. I can't thank you enough for the past year, and all I can say is I look forward to the next three. Finally, one last thanks goes out to Charles Perkins himself. I don't think that anybody would argue with the fact that he did something incredibly brave and amazing in coming here to complete his degree in the face of the massive disadvantages that Indigenous people faced at the time. However, what I think people see less is the legacy that he left us behind here at the university, one of determination, perseverance, strength, but most of all, stubbornness. I see this every day in the Indigenous students who surround me at the Koori Centre, and I can only hope that I too will live up to the heritage that he's passed on to us. Thank you so much for this award, and to everyone who's been here with me over the last 4 years. I know that I could never have come this far without you.
Oh dear. Thank you very much, Rebecca. The third prize winner is Yvonne Payne. Please come up, Yvonne.
I'd just like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal peoples, and our elders, past, present and future. I'm very nervous at the moment, in case you can't tell. I would just like to thank Sydney University and the Perkins family, and acknowledge the great man himself, whose persistence and work for the rights of Aboriginal peoples has been an inspiration to us all. And I'm hoping, now that I'm a qualified teacher, that I'm made to be able to leave my mark on the youth of the future. So I would like to thank the Koori Centre staff and the lecturers and for all the support and assistance over the years, and my cohort who were there, all my close friends. We're all so close-knit, like a second family. There are actually a few of them standing around that I've seen, so thanks for coming tonight, guys. Lastly, most importantly, I would like to thank my family and my extended family, who have put up with my studies for the last 4 years and who have supported my efforts the whole time, especially my partner Luke. So thanks very much. That's all I've got to say. Thanks very much. It's a real honour to accept this.
Don't leave your check. That's the important one. I now
invite Dr. Jeff McMullins and Charles Madden on stage to receive a gift of appreciation presented by me now. Where are we up to? yes. I'd also like to thank Hetty. And you know what? We've got a bunch of flowers, but I left them in the other room. Oh, no, here they come. So I'd like to invite Hetty onto the stage to receive her gift. I now invite Jeff McMullins to present a summation and close the proceedings for this evening. Thank you.
To bring the evening to a close, I want to go back to the question that we ask at the start. What would Charles think? And listening to you, Kerry, I thought of how well he worked with everybody. He could go overseas with his head high and be the face of Australia. He could talk to a worker in the street. He loved people like Chicka Dixon. He fired the young fellas my age, the Gary Foleys, all the mob in Redfern. And yet he could stand eyeball to eyeball with any leader of any nation on earth and explain and draw them together. He could actually make us believe that we have a lot in common and that we could get over our divisions. And that's what I listen to, that the way forward. Thank you. I don't ever remember hearing Charles shout anyone down in the crowd, and if you remember the Freedom Rides, when he was being pushed and shoved and everyone else that went with him, black or white, everyone has a right to be heard, and that's the spirit of this gathering every year, that we want the voices, and there's nothing wrong with an interjection from the back of the hall, and Kerry, you responded to it with your honesty and your strength. We have to go forward and we have to have lots of discussion. That is why there is something like the Dr. Charles Perkins annual oration here, so that we can be heard. So let's leave the room tonight in that spirit of believing that all of the voices can be heard and that we will listen to them and respect them and yet still work together to go on to that finish that unfinished business, to go on to the greatness that is still awaiting this society. I want to thank too the Perkins family for their courage and the fact that they have carried on the legacy and the belief in education, to the Currie Centre, the wonderful work that it does in inspiring the students who we see graduating at the highest level of excellence here, and also to every one of you that support this event year after year. The musicians that played earlier this evening, I hadn't acknowledged. Megan Hanlon, who was a Torres Strait Islander from Stephen Island, and also Che de Boimler, the other fine guitarist. Thank you for your music. We would invite you also to stay and talk and share your honesty and your strength and your ideas in the spirit of this occasion. Stay and I can't tell you that, but Shireen, let's continue that discussion. Let's not leave the room until we answer those questions and share the discussion. Let's talk about it. I wouldn't like to invite you then to have some refreshments in the back of the Great Hall and to stay and to talk. And also for the members of the Perkins family and the official party, the winners of the prizes tonight, to come up here to have some photographs taken. And then everyone that came here tonight, please come up and use this to have your photograph taken as a great memento of an important evening. Thank you very much.